son. And his three-year-old son is watching cartoons and Mark is scrolling on his phone, or doom scrolling as he likes to call it. And I don't know about you, but I only spend time with little kids once a week when I babysit my nieces on Friday. But I am guilty of spending a lot of time on my phone while babysitting with them because I get a little bit bored sometimes and I'm like scrolling away. And then eventually towards the afternoon, I feel like I've had kind of enough and I'm like, let's all go on our screens and we can all have quiet time. So now they all have different devices and we all like just go on our screens looking at stuff and I like can just scroll on the internet. This is like good auntie practice right here. I'm sure parents don't do this, but I do this as an aunt. So I resonate with like Mark sitting on his couch kind of scrolling. And he tells this story. So he's sitting there on the couch and he comes across this video clip of this starving polar bear. And so this polar bear is like making its way across the plain and there's like this metal container. And so the polar bear kind of pulls itself up and it's like trying to get, well, food, but there's no food. So it's kind of like eating rubbish. Now, that video clip, you know, has dramatic music playing and this sad song. And it's talking about how this polar bear is starving because of people. And this is, you know, the impact of climate change. And Mark becomes really obsessed with finding these type of video clips. Basically, ever since the birth of his son, he says, I feel this unease, like this growing sense of melancholy. He's like, you know, my life is okay, it's comfortable, but I look at my son and I start to wonder, like, yes, my life is okay, but is it good? What am I going to pass on to my son? Now, he doesn't know the answer to that, so he keeps, like, doom scrolling. And he's a writer, so he ends up researching and kind of channeling his obsession into exploring other people who think that the world is about to end, or at least the world as we know it is about to end, and who are preparing for it. Now, a lot of rich people are doing this. So there's, like, billionaires buying up property in New Zealand. So he spends some time in New Zealand. New Zealand is apparently the place to go if the world ends, or Tasmania. That's close to us. So Tasmania is ranked as a place to live if the world ends. I also spend some time with a real estate agent in South Dakota. Now, this real estate agent is selling luxury underground bunkers. So he goes and visits this place and he's like, this place is bigger than my actual home. And the real estate agent says it's very safe. It's not near any fault lines. There's no nuclear plants. You'll be very safe here. And you can customize the type of home you want. So you can design your floor plan, what type of furnishings. There's a possibility of a gym, a pool, of course. You know, depends how much money you're willing to spend. Yes, you know, we think that soon many, many people will die, but a few will be preserved and they'll be able to live here. And Mark says, isn't that interesting? Even when we're trying to imagine the end, it's kind of pretty much the same as our lives now, that like in the end, what would be preserved is all our comforts and luxury, just like kind of underground. And so it's like, first and foremost, we are still almost seen as consumers. And, you know, if you have the money, then you'll be able to consume and keep preserving this way of life. It's like, again, is this good? Is this what we want to pass on? And this is a quote from him. The bunker, purchased and tricked out by the individual consumer, is a nightmare inversion of the American dream. We might also add Australian. It's a subterranean abundance of luxury goods and creature comforts, a little kingdom of reinforced concrete and steel, safeguarding the survival of the individual and his family amid the disintegration of the world. Apocalypse has come to mean the end of the world. Some people think it's going to be very sudden, dramatic, probably violent. Other people say the end is upon us now, and it's like this slowly moving, looming crisis that we can't really see that's going to come. Some people get very excited about the end, so they like want to see it come and they're going to help usher it in. I think most people, if they think about it, feel a little bit scared, but there can often be this obsession with the world ending. And this obsession that Mark has and others have, it's nothing new. Like, it goes back right to the ancient Jewish people who kind of developed this whole genre around the end. And I think it came about because they were experiencing multiple endings. So Judah experiences the end of their nation, the end of the monarchy, the end of the temple. They get exiled. And even when they come back from exile, they're always like kind of been invaded and different people are conquering them. And so this ending and this sense of things changing rapidly is often when people become most interested in like end times. And so a lot of Jewish writers and thinkers and theologians start thinking about, is the end coming and what will be preserved? Like, what is good? Is maybe nothing, maybe the way we're living isn't good. Maybe this is why all these terrible things are happening to us. Now, in Isaiah, we see just a little glimpse of this genre. It doesn't fully develop until a little bit later. So in our Bibles, the book of Daniel is probably the main example of this in the Old Testament, and then the Revelation would be the example in the New Testament. But we see a little glimpse of this in Isaiah. Now, if you remember, we've been looking at the beginning of this term through Isaiah 12 to 23, which was like called the oracles against the nations. And so we've been looking at God's perspective on the nations. First we looked at Judah and Israel, now it's kind of been expanding out and we've been seeing what God thinks of the nations. And it's a pretty harsh assessment mostly. It's like God or Isaiah is like desperately looking for good, like almost obsessively looking for people who are doing good and not finding a lot. And so Isaiah 24 is almost like the climax. So we've been looking at all the nations and now we have this like global assessment. God is looking at the whole world and God brings this pretty confronting judgment. So reading again what Paul just read before, Isaiah 24 verse 1. Look, Yahweh is about to destroy the earth and make it a vast wasteland. He devastates the surface of the earth and scatters the people. Priests and lay people, servants and masters, maids and mistresses, buyers and sellers, lenders and borrowers, bankers and debtors, none will be spared. The earth will be completely emptied and looted. Yahweh has spoken. Apocalypse didn't actually originally mean the end of the world. That's what we think now, but more literally, it actually just means unveiling, revelation. So whenever we are told something that we couldn't possibly know, particularly about God, that's a revelation. So here, for instance, we hear God reveal that God intends to end the world, and we're actually told why. God says it's because of people and the way that they are living. Mark O'Connell says this is probably something that maybe doesn't connect necessarily with us because in our time, most people have kind of removed God out of the equation. So when we think about the world ending, we don't expect like a supernatural ending. I think most people think we will bring the ending on ourselves. Like it would be something that we would do. And so the responsibility kind of rests with us and there's nobody we can turn to. It's a little bit different in Isaiah's day. God definitely thinks people are responsible, but also there is a God, I guess, who's interested in paying attention to what is happening. And so when God looks at the world, God speaks about the earth groaning, that the earth is suffering because of the sins of the people. Humanity isn't being led by the Spirit of God, but is disobeying and violating God's ways to the point where this everlasting covenant between kind of earth and humanity has been broken and there's just this groaning of the earth in response. So when God looks at the world, God says people aren't living the way that they should and this is having an impact on the planet. Now, I don't know about you, but I find that this resonates a lot with our time now. Like it feels like it hits a little bit close to home now. And maybe it's because Isaiah frames this whole discussion by giving this list at the beginning of Isaiah 24 where he talks about a whole range of people who are going to be caught up in the end. And curiously, Isaiah talks primarily about people in economic terms. I don't know if you noticed that there, but it's like the rich, the poor, the borrower, the seller, the debtor, the lender, the banker. It's very much how we talk about people often today. A lot of people say, you know, often today, humanity is almost conceived as consumers, first and foremost. Like we're cultivated to have that sense of identity. You know, when I scroll on my phone, I'm not just doom scrolling. Sometimes I'm scrolling to do online shopping. I love online shopping because it's so easy. So you can enter any store. This is not, I mean, Brian and I were talking about security before. This is probably not good, but my like phone can just remember all my details automatically, so I don't even have to write them in. I'm like, click, you can purchase it. And sometimes I even forget what I've purchased, and then this parcel will just appear on my doorstep. It's normally books. And I'm like, wow, magic, like a book I wanted has just appeared. It's so convenient and easy and good, maybe. Jeff Bezos, who is the founder of Amazon, says, like, this is the whole point. This is the purpose of what Amazon and companies like Amazon is aiming towards. In 1997, when he was, like, giving his first shareholders meeting, he says, we must obsess about the customer, and we must be fast, we must be frictionless. So that means we want to make the process between someone clicking and ordering something to someone getting the delivery as quick and as frictionless as possible. And we want it to be relentless. We want to keep growing. In fact, he wanted to name his company Relentless, but maybe that was too obvious what they wanted to do, so they called it Amazon. But Relentless is Amazon, and even if you don't purchase products from Amazon, they have a lot of influence and holdings in the cloud, which I don't really understand. But anyway, they have a lot. They're everywhere, so you can't really avoid them, even if you don't directly buy from Amazon. Now, this has been like worked for Jeff. Like, he is the third richest person on the planet. So this model of doing business has, in some sense, been super successful for him. And what he did was, I guess, upscale, do something at this global level that's kind of never been done before. And here I am, as my little consumer person, buying stuff, and I think, this is so easy and comfortable, but is it good? Is it worth passing on? And when I ask that question, which I don't want to because I like online shopping, I am aware vaguely, you know, in the back of my head that Amazon's records around workers is pretty exploitative, and a lot of the practices do end up damaging the planet. I think, what type of life are we cultivating? Now, I think Jeff would give a different answer. I think he'd say, yes, this way is good, but maybe there just needs to be a few tweaks. So what Jeff also does is that I think around every year, he liquidates $1 billion from Amazon and he funnels it into Blue Origin, which is a research company which is all about exploring space. So he's like, this is our solution. If we want to continue to live this way, if we want unlimited growth, then we need to go to space. Yeah, like, this planet isn't enough. Like, imagine all the mining, all the resources we could tap into if we could go to space. And so I feel like there's a lot of billionaires at the moment really interested in space, because the idea is that we can keep expanding. So even if this planet one day does end, that's okay. We will, I mean, if you can afford it, we will be able to like get off our planet and keep going, maybe to Mars or whatever, and keep expanding. This way of life can be preserved and continue. It's a pretty powerful and persuasive perspective that obviously a lot of people, significant people, believe in, because they're putting their money into this. I think space, like, kind of no one was talking about it for a few, like, once we got to the moon, I feel like people got over it. But now, in the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, everyone is talking about getting into space again. And I think it's because that's one answer. If you feel like the world's going to end, let's get to space. Let's get to Mars, if you can. There are other people, probably less influential people, but there are other people who are going, maybe, though, we just need to rethink what we're doing. Maybe this way of life isn't all that it could be. So there's this theologian by the name of Rodney Clapp who's written this kind of provocative book challenging the idea of neoliberalism and saying, like, is this actually something we want to pass on? And how, as Christians, are we called to respond to this? And he says, when he looks at the current trajectory we're on, he thinks, I don't think this is good. I think we're actually going to a not-so-good place. And so this is a quote from him. If neoliberalism continues unnamed and unimpeded, the future holds gross inequality and precarity for more and more of the population. It holds entrepreneurial selves pitted against one another in a zero-sum game in which fewer and fewer will emerge as winners. Frayed social bonds will further disintegrate. A crippled ecology will be further degraded and besmirched. I don't know, we can debate what we think about neoliberalism. But Rodney goes on to say that apocalyptic texts are a kind of given to help people make a major decision. So when things like drastically need to change, you often see these texts written kind of to shake people up and confront them and make them reconsider things. And so we see this in Isaiah. We see this very dramatic language being given as Isaiah, I guess, telling God's perspective, looks around and he says, the way the world is going is not good. The trajectory is not good. And so God goes on to say, I'm going to judge the gods and the rulers who are promoting this destructive way. If you continue on this path, all that will be left is cities in ruins, weeping and deceit, a destruction falling like rain, the earth shaking and groaning, the sun fading and the glory of the moon disappearing. It gets very dramatic and heavy because it's trying to provoke a reaction. It's trying to get people, I guess, to see sin in a way maybe that we don't see it before and kind of unveil our eyes and say, anything that kind of is degrading or dehumanizing, God stands against. Whether it's whatever worldview or ideology of religion, anything that promotes that, God stands in opposition. God actually cares about these things. God cares about the actions we are taking in this world. And not only that, God cares about those who might end up harmed by such practices. Isaiah 25, verse 4. But you are a tower of refuge to the poor, O Yahweh, a tower of refuge to the needy in distress. You are a refuge from the storm and a shelter from the heat. For the oppressive acts of ruthless people are like a storm beating against a wall, or like a relentless heat of the desert. But you silence the roar of foreign nations as the shade of a cloud cools relentless heat, so the boastful songs of ruthless people are stilled. This unveiling calls people to trust that there is a God and to trust that God's ways are good. And here is an invitation for anyone who feels uneasy or anyone who has this sense of melancholy or fear about the end, for anyone who is poor, who has no possibility of buying an underground bunker or heading off to Mars, who's struggling even to pay their rent or their mortgage, God says, find your comfort and refuge in me. Put your trust in me. Now, our default is to put our trust in things because things are something we can see and, you know, we can't see God. And so sometimes it feels easier to put our trust in things and just be like, I'm going to accumulate a lot of things and then I'm going to be safe. And in fact, sometimes what I think we're trying to do is just to preserve our way of life, kind of at all costs. And the ultimate thing we want to kind of push back is, of course, death. Like, just preserve our life and keep on going kind of unendingly. Another option, if you have a lot of money, to preserve your life, so you can go to an underground bunker, you can go to Mars. The third option is cryogenics. And for the first time, I don't know if you noticed in the news, we have a facility in Sydney where this is possible. So the purpose of cryogenics is that your body gets frozen. It can only last up to 500 years. So the hope is that in 500 years' time, we will have the ability to extend life. And then I guess the dream is that you wake up and just keep living the life you've been going. Your life is preserved and that you can carry on. 27 people put $50,000 into establishing this. If you want to join, the price is now $150,000. And there's only 40 spots at this facility, so it's limited. But this is the hope, isn't it? That we can avoid the end by preserving our life, freezing ourselves, and then at some point, you know, humans will have invented a way to keep on living and we can come back and just keep our lives going. God gives a very different vision. God's not so much interested in preserving the life we have as it is, but God is interested in transforming our lives. And so Isaiah goes on to give this vision of a banquet being prepared. And this is a banquet that doesn't cost any money. It's freely given. It's open to all the people of the world. And as people come and sit at this banquet, God says, I'm going to act. I'm going to remove the cloud of gloom, this shadow of death. I'm going to swallow up death itself. I'm going to wipe away every tear. This is the dream that Isaiah gives, that transformation is possible when God acts. And then Isaiah pictures a city kind of being rebuilt. And this is a city where the gates are open, so again, open to anyone. But people who have trust in Yahweh are coming, and they're coming to learn God's ways. And so we read this in Isaiah 26, verse 8. Yahweh, we show our trust in you by obeying your laws. Our heart's desire is to glorify your name. In the night I search for you, in the morning I earnestly seek you. For only when you come to judge the earth will people learn what is right. God reveals what is good and true, and we're encouraged to kind of scroll through these visions. Let these visions shape the way that we live. Paul ends up being very steeped in these visions. Paul knew Isaiah. And so when we read a letter like the letter that Paul writes to the Corinthian church, we see Paul writing apocalyptically. He says the end has come. In the middle of history, the end has come, and God has revealed who God is when we look at the person of Jesus. And not only in Jesus' life, but particularly in his death, Paul speaks about how in Jesus' death, sin is kind of exposed. And that looming crisis we have sensed has come and kind of fallen on Jesus. And then we see God raise Jesus from the dead. That verse that Isaiah spoke about death being swallowed up in victory, and Paul directly quotes and says, that has come. We're not just like dealing with visions anymore. And when we look at the person of Jesus, we see what God imagined and spoke about coming into being. And we are invited into that resurrected life. We are invited to join what God is doing, kind of to be set free from death and the ways of life that contribute to death. And so Paul encourages the Corinthian church to stand firm in the foundation that they have been given. And we see that when you grasp that, when you grasp that the end has kind of come and that God's power is at work and that God can raise the dead, it like changes people. And people start to live differently. Like the early church knew, we're not just individuals, we're not just consumers, we're actually a beloved community found in Jesus. And so they did some radical things, like pulling together all of their resources, like making sure that nobody in their community was in need, that everybody was supported. They were pursuing a life that was good, and for them, it was a life marked by generosity. That was worth passing on. Now, of course, the early church is often held up as like the exemplar, and then it quickly stops. So what does it look like in our time? Well, an Australian Christian that I find confronting and challenging is a man named Jonathan Cornford. He made the decision with his wife very early on that they were going to put a limit to the amount of income that they would take. So they wanted to live a very simple life, and they, along with a few of their friends, moved to Bendigo, and they start kind of living in an intentional kind of community, trying to look like, starting in our house, what would it look like if we took seriously the revelation of Jesus? How does that change the way that we do economics? How does that change the way that we use our resources, that we do stuff in our own homes? Now, not everyone's going to be able to do what he and his wife did, but what they do give is like kind of questions that people can ask if people want to think about, what does it look like to live differently? He says, you know, Christians, we kind of look like everybody else most of the time. We're all on our phones, scrolling and clicking away, but we are meant to be people who have been set free. We're meant to be people who live differently. And so he talks about maybe we need to take our phones away a little bit more. Maybe we need to break that addiction to scrolling all the time. Maybe we need to consume less. Maybe we need to learn to repair more. There's no one way to do this. But it's trying to think about, in light of the salvation and the freedom that we've been given, how do we live differently? And so he says this, attempting to reclaim a Christian practice of household economy is an ethical response to the destructive economics of our time. Beginning to reshape our own household practices, it represents a basic Christian commitment to right relationship and to be the change we want to see in the world. That is partly what the New Testament means when it speaks of the people of God as the first fruits of the age to come. When God speaks or reveals, God does speak about endings, but I don't think it's something we have to be scared of. Actually, Endings allow space for beginnings. It allows space for the Spirit of God to be at work. And so we're invited, actually, as Christians, one of the things we're supposed to do regularly is kind of die to ourselves, isn't it? To crucify sin or things that are wrong in our lives and to pick up this new way of life that God calls us into. It's kind of like old language in a sense. I don't know how much we're very good at doing that, but that's the language that Paul often uses. If we are found in Christ, we are dying to ourselves and picking up this new life with the power of the Spirit leading us into something good and everlasting. So today I want to give you a moment, I'm going to stop talking, to pray and to think about what are the things I need to die to? And, you know, we've been talking a lot about money today, so maybe that's an area you want to think of. Is there things in my household or my phone addiction that maybe I need to rethink? Is there things I need to lay down and end? And to bring that to God, because those things are not easy. Change is not easy. And ask God, what do I need to surrender and give up so that you can feel and bring something new? Let me give you a moment to spend some time with God in prayer, and then I'll close with a promise from Isaiah. For those who die in Yahweh will live. Their bodies will raise again. Those who sleep in the earth will rise up and sing for joy. For your life-giving light will fall like dew on your people in the place of the dead. Amen.